On Tech News Today, Twitter sues the government, Watson learns Spanish, and Microsoft releases a better Snapchat than Snapchat. It's all coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, October 8th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and we have a Jason Fest today, starting with Jason Howell. How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing all right. And just to prove to you that peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are real in my life,
Did you bring enough for everybody?
My daughter left this in my car, and so now I have to eat it, and it's okay because I like them.
You have a hungry daughter and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Apparently.
Fair trade-off. Life isn't always fair.
There we go.
We also have with us Jason Heiner, our guest co-anchor today. How you doing, Jason Heiner?
Excellent. The lesser Jason of the day.
I'm not sure. All Jasons are equal in our eyes.
Just because you don't have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich doesn't make you any lesser of a Jason. It's okay.
I am jelly.
You do have a ferocious beard and a new office, so you guys have your new offices. Where are you in New York City?
Yeah, this is actually, we're in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, that's right, of course.
Yeah, our headquarters are in Louisville, Kentucky. We moved into, ironically, the same office complex. We moved back to the office complex where Tech Republic launched as a startup in 1999. So it's a little nostalgic, but we were kind of expanding here. And so, yeah, this is our new digs.
Awesome. That is very cool. And, you know, Jason, I don't know if you go to Apple events. I don't. I'm on the blacklist for reporting fairly and honestly as an opinion columnist. But they are having another event next Thursday, October 16th, on at 10 a.m. Pacific, which they always do. Our coverage will be at 9:30 a.m. But what do you think they're going to announce? I think people are expecting another iPad, maybe a Mac or two, a MacBook or something like that. What do you expect?
Yeah. It should be iPad and Mac stuff. And I don't go either. I'm on the list of people who sometimes say mean things about Apple. And so, I think that one of the things that I haven't heard in a while, there were these rumors of mystery products, a number of different mystery products. And so, we got one, of course, last time, the Apple Watch came to fruition. But I'm just going to throw it out there. One of the things that they haven't talked about in a while that they're kind of do is what their living room strategy is. And so, nobody's mentioned anything about panels, them making, a TV with, Apple TV built in, or some new version of Apple TV, which they've kind of quietly been doing some things with over the past couple years. So I'm going to sort of float that out there, that maybe we're going to actually hear something about the living room. And they're sort of overdue to talk about that. And it could be as simple as an Apple TV update, or maybe it could be, something more. There'd probably be more buzz about it and supply chain leaks if there were. But who knows?
I'm with you. I think that the most likely product that would surprise us all would be an Apple TV that also supports home automation. I've been kind of predicting that for Apple and kind of pointing out that it makes obvious sense for them to do that for about 3 years now. But the problem with Apple is just when they think they're on the brink of something, you're probably about 2 years out. I mean, look at the iWatch. We thought that was going to come in every single announcement for probably about 2 years, and so they are a slow moving company. That's the bad view of it. The good view of it is that they wait until the market is just right. They're just very careful at crafting the perfect timing. But I think that if they do surprise us, that's the most likely thing. I don't think they're ever going to just come out with a big TV set.
I don't think it makes sense either, Mike. I'll be honest. I think it would be interesting, and obviously there's ideas that they're going to do something. But it is such a brutal market. TVs, people forget that everybody that thinks that they're going to do a TV, I think sometimes forgets what a brutal, you know, race to the bottom TVs are. You know, there are no margins. It's a tough market to be in. I don't even think they could bring a premium product to market and have, you know, a whole lot of luck making much profit in that business. They'd have to do something a little different. Home automation is one idea, kind of like you said, if that TV sort of involves home automation, it involves some other stuff, then where they could, you know, justify sort of charging more. But yeah, I don't see them just doing a big screen. It just doesn't make economic sense for a company that's really focused on margin, product margins.
Yeah, you're not going to replace it annually, and therefore Apple is probably not going to be super excited about that market. Well, let's jump into the news. Twitter is suing the U.S. government. The lawsuit is intended to force several government agencies to allow Twitter to talk more about government requests for user data. Lily Hay Newman is a reporter for Slate, and we also have with us Aaron Boyd at FederalTimes.com. Welcome to you both.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, Lily Hay Newman, let's start with you. Twitter says current rules prevent disclosure, preventing the disclosure, the thing that they're railing against here and suing over, violates the First Amendment rights of users. Does the First Amendment really protect someone's right to be informed when the government requests their data?
Well, people are talking about whether that this is stopping users from getting vital information about their government and decisions that their government is making that Twitter should be allowed to disclose. So I think it's sort of two levels, Twitter's speech to their users so that the users have vital information about their government.
I see. Now, would Twitter, Aaron, let me ask you something. Would Twitter inform each user every time a government requested their data? I mean, is this what they essentially want to do?
No, and any disclosure would be about batches of requests from the federal government. So specifically what Twitter's looking to do is put out there how often the government is asking to look for information and specifically what kinds of information they're looking for. But it certainly wouldn't be any specifics on which users or the actual information they're looking for.
You guys, how about, you know, the idea is, you know, do you see this sparking some issues or is it plugging into the bigger issue of, you know, what in a kind of a free society citizens have the right to, what information we should have the right to, and that balance? Do you see this triggering more of this debate, or is it only people that, you know, really wonks and people like us that are talking about that stuff? Because that's obviously what is at the heart of this issue is, you know, what rights do people have in a free society to information on what the government's doing and balancing that, of course, with security, you know, and sort of national security.
Go ahead.
Aaron, why don't you go ahead?
So in this instance, it's really a question of scope. Again, because even if Twitter was allowed to release all the information that they're looking to release, it's not about the specifics. It's about how much the government is looking into Twitter users. So I think the question becomes just looking at what the government is doing in general around these sort of things and not so much on an individual level.
Lily, how many requests for user information does Twitter get? It seems like they don't have a lot of data. 140 characters isn't a lot of information. And I assume they're talking mostly about private direct messages, that sort of thing.
Right. So Twitter doesn't have the scale of requests that some of the other big tech companies have. I think they had about 2,000 this last quarter, whereas Google is in, I think it's the 30,000s, you know, so just by quarter. So Twitter isn't the biggest player for this, but I think that's why they're an especially good company to take the stand in a way, because it's like they're just sort of a first step. And they're saying, even if this isn't something that would seem to be crucial to our users, it's important to us, and it's going to be important to other companies too.
Now, Aaron, in December, 8 companies leaned on the government to restrict government surveillance. Do you think that effort was successful? Did they actually make a dent there?
They did. In fact, because they were eventually allowed to report at least a certain amount of information, and their efforts actually go to the core of Twitter's current lawsuit. Because they were eventually allowed to release information in what's called batches of 1,000, So they could say for every how many thousands of requests were made. Now, Twitter, having a much smaller number of requests, they're actually specifically looking to be able to identify smaller batches, in some instances as low as in ranges of 25. So part of the problem here is that back in December, though the decisions made back then kind of set up the statutes that now Twitter is being forced to abide by, and they don't really see themselves as playing in that same realm. They see themselves as a little bit different.
Lily Hayne Newman writes at Slate.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Lily H. Newman. Thank you so much for joining us, Lily.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and Aaron Boyd is at FederalTimes.com, and you can follow him on his shiny new Twitter feed, Federal_IT. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you.
All right. Well, in just a sec, we're going to tell you about IBM's Watson. There's some new capabilities going on there that will blow your mind. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the awesome place to build an incredible website. I have built a lot of incredible websites. People in my family have built incredible websites. A lot of my friends have done it as well. It's just so fun to do because the end product, which you can generate and crank out in no time at all, super easy to do, is a beautiful, robust, fully modern website. And if you want to build a blog, you want to sell things, Squarespace is the place to do it. They have tech support that's really great, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I've used it once or twice myself. It's so easy to use, you pretty much don't need tech support, truth be told. But if you do use it, they really know what they're talking about. They get it back to you right away. It's a real human being. They don't try to scrape you off on a knowledge base somewhere. A real person actually answers your question. Now, when you look at Squarespace websites, they're so awesome, and they look so great, and they're so robust. You think, well, this is going to cost a fortune. But in fact, Squarespace starts at just $8 a month. And that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And of course, they're mobile ready. You can manage your site using the mobile apps that they provide to you for free. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT to get 10% off and to show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, remember IBM's Watson? The IBM's Jeopardy-playing artificial intelligence system, well, the company keeps investing in it a lot and giving more capabilities. The company opened a new office yesterday in New York City, a big one too, and they answered some questions about what Watson is up to these days. Alex Barinka is a reporter for Bloomberg News and joins us now. Welcome to you, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Now, everybody's heard of Watson. People might have seen the system on Jeopardy, but I don't think most people know what Watson is exactly. Is it a computer? Is it an application? Is it a set of applications? What is Watson?
So technically, it's a set of servers and a power system. But the secret sauce for Watson is really the software that they're running. It's a cloud-based system that crunches huge amounts of data and can kind of spit out either answers to certain questions or find patterns in, you know, what IBM likes to call natural language, so in plain English.
Interesting. Now you reported that Watson has learned to speak Spanish, with more languages coming soon. Now, what will IBM do with this multilingual capability?
So with some of these, their customers are like TaxiBank, SoftBank is working with them on Japanese. There's another bank working with them on Brazilian Portuguese. These customers are going to be using Watson to help advise their clients. And, you know, the Spanish customers probably want this help in Spanish. So, English is a complicated language in and of itself. So when they're going through hundreds and thousands of pages of information just in English, that's a huge jump to begin with. So with this new language capabilities, they'll be able to better communicate with their clients will be better to communicate with their own customers.
Alex, one of the things that IBM has sort of talked about wanting to do with Watson is make it available on mobile phones, you know, kind of be like, Siri, but, you know, on steroids.
Right.
And that kind of thing. Have they talked any more about mobile, what their plans for mobile and, you know, beefing up their mobile app and making access to some of the things that it does, you know, on mobile devices?
Yeah, you know, mobile's kind of been one of their big talking points lately. You saw the tie-up with Apple where they're bringing these 100 enterprise apps to iOS operating systems. Today, I was at the event this morning, got to see the location there in New York, and, you know, they did kind of roll out some of these apps, some of these partner startups who are working with them. You saw Terry Jones, the chairman of Kayak, you know, rolling out a new company, Wayblazer, to help people plan their travel. So mobile, in terms of user experience, is very much central to what IBM's trying to enable their partners to do. It really is kind of where they're moving, which is why Watson is now a cloud-based system. When we saw it 3 years ago on Jeopardy, it was basically, you know, one stack of boxes, and that was it. And now they've kind of opened up the API and allowed developers to access the data analytics capabilities and integrate that into whatever applications that they want, whether it be mobile or desktop.
Now, how much has IBM invested in Watson so far? And do we have any idea whether they're losing money, making money? What's going on from a financial perspective with Watson?
Yeah, so, you know, they've been working on this for a while, but the latest investments, really in January, is where they've kind of come out and tried to start commercializing it. They did that with $1 billion investment in building out this new headquarters in New York. And they... The linchpin for you know, the investment community and for us watching the company closely, they haven't really given sales numbers for any of the partnerships or any of the customers that they do have. They say that, you know, customers pay right now. The API is open, free to access, and they pay on a usage basis. But that could also change depending on the customer, because remember, the majority of IBM's business is consulting. So if they're working closely with somebody, then it might be a different payout. But, you know, IBM as a whole expects data analytics to be $20 billion in 2015. That's out of, you know, $100 billion in revenue for the year. So Watson, it might be a little part of that, but right now it really kind of looks like this is the face for them, and they're not quite to the point where they're disclosing how much they're making off of this tool.
Alex Barinka is at Bloomberg.net, and you can follow her on Twitter at Alex Barinka. That's Barinka with a K near the end. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Thank you.
All right. Well, as announced in April, Facebook yesterday opened its ad network called the Facebook Audience Network. The change means advertising based on your Facebook personal data may now show up outside of Facebook. Reed Albergati is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joins us. Welcome to you, Reed Albergati.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote that Facebook has 1.5 million advertisers. That's today. Would this new option grow the 1.5 million, or will it mostly give those same advertisers more places to advertise?
Well, this isn't actually an attempt to grow the number of advertisers, although it may, if you consider this a feature that a lot of advertisers want, it could pull more people in. But what it really does is allow advertisers that are currently using Facebook, buying Facebook ads, to expand the number of places that those ads appear. Now, this is actually only on the mobile web. So let's say an advertiser buys an ad on Facebook. Instead of just appearing in a Facebook news feed, that ad could appear on a mobile app, a game like, let's say, Angry Birds. And also today, or yesterday actually, this was now opened up to any app. So any app can send in an application and say, I want to have Facebook ads appear on my app.
So is this going to have the kind of impact on their sort of revenue and you know, their business, the way you know, having AdWords did for Google once they sort of let everybody else kind of put it on their own sites, you know, that kind of thing? Is that the expectation, that this is going to help them, you know, become a massive ad network, compete with, you know, ad networks that are out there, use their customer data to target people in much sort of better and you know, more targeted ways than other ad networks? Can they deliver on that?
This is absolutely a play to increase Facebook's revenue, its bottom line. So if you think about Facebook as, you know, a big auction for ads, everyone is bidding on this space on Facebook. And as the company gets more and more advertisers, the bidding keeps going up. The prices keep going up for those ads on Facebook. That is a good thing until the ads get so full, that the ad inventory on Facebook becomes so expensive that advertisers pull out. So the ad network allows an additional inventory. And Facebook was kind of waiting for this moment. It's essentially a pendulum swinging, right? So, you know, Facebook doesn't want to share any of that revenue with additional websites, additional apps, unless it has to. And, you know, this is really that point where Facebook says, yeah, I mean, the ads, our inventory is so full that we just need to expand the tentacles. And yeah, I think, you know, this should allow their revenue to continue to grow, maybe not at the rate it has in the past, but at a good rate that'll satisfy investors.
I think it's kind of funny that, you know, critics of contextual advertising say that in this business model, you, the user, are the product. And in fact, they labeled it the Facebook Audience Network. They're actually labeling this product as what you're buying as the audience, which is kind of interesting. Now, I was pretty amazed at your story because you described how easy it will be for existing Facebook advertisers to add advertising outside of Facebook. Can you quickly describe that process?
Yeah, advertisers have to, you know, essentially check a box. They can use all of the same targeting that they used in the past. So, you know, that's age, gender, location, and also, you know, interest-based advertising, which is kind of a new thing for Facebook. They track the browsing, the off-Facebook browsing of their users and see which websites they're visiting and then determine the types of things that they're into. And then by checking this box, essentially those ads can follow people around the web. So let's say you're, you know, surfing your favorite tech news website, you might see an ad that's targeted to you based on the information that Facebook has on you.
Now, I've always been unimpressed by the ability of Facebook to target advertising at me. It could be because I'm a kind of a weird user. I do a lot of research on things that aren't necessarily my personal interest there, more have to do with the research I do for the show or whatever. And so I could be an odd case, but I've talked to a lot of people who relate the same thing. This is really the core business that they're offering. This is really the differentiator that they're offering for advertisers as opposed to other sources of advertising. Do you think that they'll be able to pull it off? Will advertisers be satisfied by their ability to target these ads?
Well, so far, advertisers have been, you know, pretty satisfied with Facebook's targeting ability. Sorry, my camera moved there. You know, Facebook has what Google does not have, which is real names, real identity. You have to use, you know, your real information on Facebook. And that's extremely valuable to advertisers because if you're just using, you know, the traditional targeting tools on the web, cookies that are implanted on your computer and your web browser, you're kind of guessing just based on your activity on the web. So the targeting is pretty good. And, you know, this move to increase the options of the ad network doesn't actually really increase the targeting, although, you know, there may be ways that Facebook could gather more information as these ads expand on the web. What this really does is just allow that targeting to be used all over the internet and not just on Facebook.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, the real names thing is a bit of a fiction. I mean, I could create a Facebook account right now and call myself Reed Albergardi II, and they would have no idea. As long as it looks like a legitimate name, they really have no way to verify it unless somebody complains or something like that. But still, you know, the vast majority...
Well, Facebook discloses... Well, I just say Facebook does disclose those numbers, and they admit in their SEC filings that that is a possibility, and they estimate, I think it's somewhere around 6%, of users could be using duplicate names or alternate names on Facebook. And then there's also another somewhere around 2% where people could be, you know, fraudulently creating these bots on Facebook. So it's all in the SEC filings. And I think, you know, advertisers take those numbers into account.
Yeah, it's never perfect, no matter what they do. Reed Albergati is at WSJ.com. That's the Wall Street Journal's website. And you can follow him on Twitter at Reed Albergati. Thanks a lot for joining us, Reed.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Microsoft's research lab just cranked out a new photo sharing app called Zim. Like Snapchat, the app deletes shared photos after a certain amount of time. But unlike Snapchat, the recipient doesn't need to have the Zim app installed in order to receive the picture. The pictures live in the cloud and they can be viewed with any browser. Now, here's the cool part. If the sender swipes or zooms on a picture, the recipients, everybody who got that link, will see that action in real time. The first version is for Windows Phone only, and that version ships today. Future versions for iOS and Android are in the works. This looks to me pretty cool, Jason Heiner. What do you think about this? Is this a market saturated, or does Microsoft have a shot here?
No, I think this is interesting, partially because Snapchat still has a little bit of a reputation issue. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people who don't want to install Snapchat because it has this, you know, reputation from when it first started of being, you know, a bit of a porn engine. And so, whereas in fact now it's not so much any longer. It has gone a little more mainstream, but because of that residual effect, I think there's a lot of people who wouldn't install it. So I think there's room to do this, and there's room, I think, partially because in both Facebook and Twitter, people, you know, in general, people have gotten a little more wise about what they post, and so people have curated the things that they post on both of those networks. In many cases, not all, but because people have these, we live these a little bit more curated lives on social media. The thing about the appeal of something like Snapchat or Zim is that you can do stuff that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, put out there and you want to be around forever. You know, a joke or, you know, something, a picture that you wouldn't necessarily post that might be kind of funny, but it might be offensive to some of your friends and not others, or that kind of thing. And so I think there's definitely room to do this kind of thing. And the fact that they're making it easy enough that you don't have to have an app installed is probably good. I think ultimately probably it will end up being app based because people still love apps and apps aren't showing too much too many signs of running out of steam. But I think it's got potential. I would certainly give it a try.
Absolutely, and I'm going to try it too. There are two elements to this that I think are also fascinating in addition to the inherent fascination of this kind of app. The first of which is that Microsoft's research lab, this one actually is coming from Microsoft's Fuse research lab, that they're just putting out these apps. I think that's a great model. Microsoft has historically struggled to get apps out of there, you get technology into products and out into the world. Their research arm is amazing. They do amazing research, and then it's like, where is it? You see the research, and you never see it in products. And so it's great to see them directly getting this out there. The second thing is Microsoft's new sort of multi-platform strategy. They promised versions very soon for iOS and Android, and that is a great development. I think that's the right strategy for Microsoft.
I agree. It really is for everybody. Apple and Google should be doing the same, and they are to lesser extents in some ways. But it's one of the main metrics of the economy. It's an attention economy, you know, that we live in, and so they need to take those kinds of things in mind. All of those companies, all these tech companies, are not just about selling products in the traditional sense. They software and or hardware. They really are, you know, data companies, and that's what you are when you put apps out like this. You know, you're a user data company, essentially.
Absolutely. Well, in just a second, we're going to tell you about Apple's Sapphire situation. But first, I'm going to tell you how to hire awesome people using ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is a great product, and I wish this was around back when I was doing a lot of hiring. Unfortunately, I've also done a lot of firing in my career, and sometimes you have to fire people because you hired the wrong person. And that is a terrible thing to do to the person. It's a terrible thing for your company. And it's horrible for you. You don't want to do any of that stuff. You want to hire the right people, lots of them, all the best people that you can get in all of your positions. And that way, your company will be more successful and you'll be more successful in your career. Here's how ZipRecruiter does it. They let you post your job to more than 50 job boards with a single click. This is not only job boards, but also social media, all the places where the best candidates are scattered all over the internet. And they just go out there, cast this very wide net, and then they bring them in. But they don't just dump all of these candidates at you. They filter them to make sure that only the qualified candidates are put front and center so you can just go through them and hire the right person fast. ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 250,000 businesses, and this is the right way to hire the best people, and you owe it to yourself to use ZipRecruiter because it's just nothing like it. Right now, our viewers and listeners can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Remember, that's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. We told you yesterday about Apple's Sapphire partner called GT Advanced Technologies filing for bankruptcy. The announcement wiped out 90% of the company's value on the stock market, and today, Apple said they were surprised by the move and didn't see it coming. Apple said via a spokesman that the company is committed to preserving jobs in Arizona, where GT employs some 700 people, and that could mean acquisition of the company. It could mean something else. Who knows what they're going to do? I think Apple is going to need Sapphire in the future. GT Advanced Technologies has some really interesting technology. Jason Heiner, what do you think is going to happen to this whole Sapphire situation? First of all, do you think Sapphire is going to end up on the next version of the iPhone? And second of all, do you think GT Advanced Technologies is going to remain a partner? Are they going to go out of business, or is Apple going to acquire them?
It's a good question. I guess it depends on if there are other competitors out there, that, you know, how viable other competitors are and if they can get, you know, good prices from them and that kind of thing. I wouldn't be surprised to see Apple buy a Sapphire company. You know, one of the biggest things that one of the biggest problems with all these phones and the iPhone, because there's lots of them running around out there, especially in the U.S. at least, is that, you know, there's broken screens. And the iPhone is one that probably gets, you know, a case. I see a lot more people using iPhones without cases than I see, you know, on other phones. So, you know, the broken screens are huge, huge deal. It's like this whole other market. I'd love to know the size of the iPhone repair, screen repair market. It's probably pretty significant. So one of the things that Apple could do to drive up customer satisfaction, clearly, is to make, you know, this virtually indestructible kind of screen. There, you know, Sapphire's one option could go in another direction. When I was at when I was in Israel at a research facility last year, they were showing that this glass that they use on windows there. They have these windows in Israel that literally, if a rocket hits that, the rocket's going to bounce off a window. You know, it's impenetrable. And so they were talking about the fact that they're trying to then take this to market. It's made from this little dust, a powder. And they were talking, though, that they want to take this to market and use it for cell phones as a way for people to, as a way for vendors, phone makers, to do. So there are competitors to Sapphire, including some polymers, you know, some artificial things like this. So they could go in that direction, too. It's not necessarily that they have to do Sapphire, but I definitely expect them to do, and all the phones to do, one of these kind of almost like bulletproof, you know, breakproof kind of screens.
I think we saw a glimpse into the future of the iPhone screen when we saw the Apple Watch announced. The Apple Watch has a really interesting screen. It's Sapphire, or two of the three models are Sapphire. One of them isn't Sapphire. And It's a curved Sapphire, and it's also pressure and touch sensitive. So it gives a little. It's flexible.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's a pretty safe bet that flexible, curved, touch-sensitive screens are coming to iPhones in the future. And, of course, they're going to need tons of Sapphire for that, because the way you do Sapphire, basically, is you grow it. You grow this big block of it, big round sort of wheel-shaped block, and then you carve the screen out of it. And It's an expensive process. It's, you know, 3-4 times more expensive than Gorilla Glass. But, you know, it if it works, if it's bulletproof, if it doesn't scratch, that's the most important thing. It's less scratch. Yeah. It's more scratch resistant than Gorilla Glass or regular glass. And if it doesn't scratch, it's unlikely to shatter when you drop it. So I think we're going to see a lot of innovation from Apple. I just can't believe they won't acquire this company and control it all themselves, unless there's some reason that I don't know about why they wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, it would be more cost effective, maybe, eventually, to use something like this powder, that you create the powder and then you essentially bake it to make it. It would seem like that's a less complicated, but potentially longer term, maybe more economical, if you can get all the supply chain things in order. But so it may be Sapphire, maybe something else, but I think you're right. I think it will be interesting to watch, and I think that the screens on these phones are going to be a lot different. In 5 years, they're not going to look anything like the ones that we have today.
Yeah, and of course, Apple, it has to be said, has an additional constraint that a lot of companies don't really have, which is that whatever technology they embrace, whatever technology they use in the manufacturing of their devices, especially their iPhones, they have to be able to manufacture 100 million of them in a few months.
Yeah.
And so that is a huge challenge. Like, how do you do that? How do you do this at massive scale, very rapidly? And that's a consideration for whatever technology they pick. It has to be done very quickly at a very large scale. Well, in other news, remember the 1993 open world PC game called Myst? It was the first of its genre. It was a rich, artful landscape with these mysterious puzzles and clues all over the place. Well, now the game is being turned into a TV show, according to a report at Deadline. Legendary TV and Digital Media has signed a deal with Scion Worlds to create a TV series. And also, I think the best part is, they're also going to create a new companion video game based on the original Myst. How cool is that, Jason Heiner? I bet you played this back in the day.
I did play Myst, yeah. I mean, it was pretty cool stuff back then. I mean, the graphics on this were really cool. And the storytelling, the way that it handled storytelling was pretty unique at the time. It was this very kind of immersive first person, you know, mystery kind of thing. And it was groundbreaking. I remember it. I remember having a lot of fun with it. And so, and because I sort of have that good memory, you know, of it, I'm sort of interested. I don't watch much TV, but I would think about tuning in on this.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to see what they do with it, with the idea. Well, behold, the Google Street View Camel now exists. In order to add Google Maps Street View photos of the Liwa Desert in the United Arab Emirates, Google lashed a special camera called the Trekker to a camel's hump and then guided the dromedary across the open sand dunes of the vast Liwa Desert. And now they have a gazillion pictures of sand dunes. Wow, that is nuts. This is a beautiful imagery here. I doubt that sort of like satin blanket that they have there is a Google product, but that camera looks familiar.
I mean, don't sand dunes change a lot over time, too? Because, you know, the sand flies around everywhere, so.
Well, you know, that could be one reason to do this. I mean, this is a, what they're essentially mapping there is it's a road, essentially. It's the equivalent of a road. People traverse that specific thing. And, you know, if they run that poor camel back and forth across the sand there to keep up with some of these changes, maybe it would help people navigate across that space.
So what you're saying is there's soon to be a camel mode in Google Maps navigation. There'll be car, walking, biking, and camel.
That's right. Okay. Exactly. Maybe cool. Camels will start using it. Who knows? Right. Well, our TNT fan of the day is David Grant in Tucson, Arizona, who said he listens hands-free while driving through the desert, different desert, to serve his assistive technology clients. Check that out. How cool is that? He's got the Google Glass going on. He's got the Google Glass earpiece in there, and then he's got the show running right there. How cool is that? Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. That is the Tech News Today. Jason Heiner, thank you so much for joining us today. Always love it when you're on the show.
Same here. Love being here, always.
I just wish I disagreed with you once in a while. I pretty much agree entirely with everything that comes out of your mouth. It's kind of annoying. All right, man. Well, take care. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, of course. YouTube is a great place. Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, many, many options. Just choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. That's twit.tv/TNT. You can also follow us on Twitter. Tech News Today TV is our Twitter name. And you can subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And please send us your thoughts, opinions, and ideas. Just send email to tnt@twit.tv. You can also call us at 260-TNT-SHOW. Leave a message. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Nice.